This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, focus on Africa, Somalia, South Sudan, U.S. anti-terrorism exercises with African forces, and Chadian President Hissène Habré found guilty by a Senegalese court of crimes against humanity, war crimes, and torture. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. We'll examine the implications of the deadly attack on the Ambassador Hotel in Mogadishu, Somalia, and discuss challenges as the country prepares for elections in August. We'll ask why the transitional government of national unity in South Sudan has been unable to secure peace and stability. In addition, we will discuss the effectiveness of U.S. State Department-funded efforts to train African police and security forces to defend civilian targets on a continent that has become a significant battleground in the war against militant Islam. With us to analyze all this are two distinguished African analysts who are no strangers at these VOA microphones. Ambassador David Chin is former U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso. He's currently professor of international affairs at George Washington University, and he blogs at the official blog of Ambassador David H. Chin. And J. Peter Pham, he's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. That's a policy group based here in Washington. And Peter is just back from a trip to Khartoum. And both gentlemen join us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
Well, Peter, let me begin with you. You just got off the plane not too long ago from Khartoum, and I'd like to get your reaction to what's going on first in Somalia. We take note that al-Shabaab militants detonated a deadly car bomb at the gates of the Ambassador Hotel in Mogadishu last week, killing at least 15, wounding dozens. Why, in your view, after years of retreat, has al-Shabaab been stepping up attacks on civilians, peacekeepers, and Somalia's security forces?
Carol, well, al-Shabaab has been suffering a number of defeats militarily since 2011, being pushed out of Mogadishu and progressively losing the territory it once controlled in south-central Somalia. That doesn't mean that the group itself went away quietly into the dark. In fact, the group has proven itself increasingly resilient, rebuilding its forces, refocusing its energies on asymmetric terrorist type of attacks, such as what we saw this week, and which we've seen previous years with attacks like the Westgate Mall in Nairobi, Kenya, and the Grisus University College in northeastern Kenya. And so we're just seeing more of these attacks as the group reasserts itself. And it's not surprising, and unfortunately, this perhaps is the price of having proclaimed victory and success all too soon.
Do you think this U.S. strike on Mohamed, also known as Douliadane, who masterminded the April 2015 attack on that Garissa University in Kenya, do you think that had something to do with this attack by al-Shabaab, this attack, of course, on Douliadane having just occurred a day or two before?
It may well have, although al-Shabaab has been hitting soft targets, civilian targets in Mogadishu and other population centers with, unfortunately, some regularity in recent months. So whether the two are linked, we're not certain. The one thing that we are aware is, in addition to this militant, Douliadane, who was apparently killed in this attack, reports are also that the head of Shabaab's internal intelligence service, a fellow who's known as Haji Daoud, was also killed in the attack. And these are significant successes, but eliminating a few leaders is not going to put an end to this insurgency.
Turning to you, Ambassador Chin, for your take on this terrible attack on the Ambassador Hotel and to what extent it may be linked to the drone attack on these two militants, what is your take?
I'm not convinced that there's any direct link. It may have even taken longer than 2 days to plan this event at the Ambassador Hotel. It's possible. I don't rule it out. But I think what is more significant here is that these attacks, as Peter has suggested, have been going on routinely for quite some period of time. And a lot of these senior leaders have been taken out over the last 5 years. But they somehow, al-Shabaab keeps coming back with new senior leaders. So they're able somehow to recruit from the ranks or recruit from someplace new leadership to take over, which is the worrisome part and which suggests to me that the bigger part of the problem is the lack of a political settlement in Somalia. So long as you do not have widespread agreement on where the political process is going in the country, I think al-Shabaab will be able to continue these kinds of attacks. And they've even expanded them in the last year or so to take on units of AMISOM, and in some cases with a degree of success. So there's a long way to go before al-Shabaab is out of the picture.
Indeed. And then we hear also that we have IS, that is the so-called Islamic State, is also recruiting to some extent a rival for al-Shabaab. So perhaps al-Shabaab feels it needs to step it up. I mean, Peter, what other strategies, tactics need to be adopted and implemented to combat this scourge? Obviously, you know, picking off leaders, as you both alluded to, is just simply not enough. And then we have Somalia elections, presumably in August, and Ambassador Shin talks about a political settlement needing to occur to ultimately resolve the problem. So to what extent are we even going to be able to have free and fair elections in this climate?
Well, Ambassador Shin is totally correct. I fully agree with what he said about the need for a political settlement. That's the only way. Military actions can clear out a space, temporal and physical space, but that has to be filled with something. Unless that's done, it's a repetitious cycle. And 4 years ago, the current government was installed, and the promise was made at the time that there would be elections 4 years from now. The international community and the Somali government have reached the conclusion that it's not practical to hold elections, so they're going to, again, co-opt a parliament and then indirectly select a president. So although that's understandable from the security point of view, that pushing off of a political settlement and making it more or less a game between elites continues, and that simply pushes out of the space for groups like al-Shabaab, as well as, you know, there aren't that many, but there is some resonance of the so-called Islamic State among some parts of the Somali radical population as well.
Ambassador Shin, back to you. We're getting reports that IS is on the rise, that is the so-called Islamic State, getting support from Yemen in Somalia. How do you see these insurgencies and the possibility of a political settlement in the near future? What about the elections that were supposed to have taken place in August?
Well, as far as the Islamic State is concerned, I think they're still quite weak in Somalia. And as you suggested, I think there is a link between the stepped-up attacks by al-Shabaab, which has an al-Qaeda connection, and their effort to show that we are the important party here, not you, the new arrivals who are linked to the Islamic State. So far, the Islamic State seems to have been confined primarily to Puntland and the northernmore parts of the country. As far as the elections are concerned, as Peter indicated, they're indirect elections. It's not one person, one vote. It's two houses of parliament that will be selected. There is one house of parliament now, a unicameral arrangement. It will now become two. And they will be selected on an indirect basis, drawing upon the 4.5 clan system, a very complicated mechanism that's not very popular. And then they will get together and meet after they are created in August and in September vote for the president. So the president will be elected indirectly, in effect. This is not the long-term solution. This is not going to ingratiate this government with a vast majority of the Somali people. But I understand why they're doing it, because you do not have adequate security to have one person one vote. You couldn't do it right now. It's impossible.
That's an understatement, certainly. Well, turning to South Sudan, back to you, Peter Pham. You just got back from Khartoum. You certainly have your finger on the pulse of what's going on both in Sudan and South Sudan. Let's take a look at the inability of this transitional government sworn in over a month ago to establish any kind of security. The UN Security Council just this week unanimously adopted a resolution to renew sanctions against South Sudan's leaders for another year, invoking travel bans and asset freezes because they have impeded the peace and stability of the country. What's going on?
Well, several things, Carol. One is that the international community is trying to push an interim arrangement, a government of national unity, putting together the very forces that fell apart and, if you will, had that ugly divorce that resulted in the civil war, which cost tens of thousands of lives and displaced literally millions of people. But this forced cohabitation isn't founded upon anything other than the desire to stop the current fighting, which itself is a small mercy. But it's not a long-term solution. You've got two leaders who essentially destroyed their nation before it even got its start, neither of whom, if there were free and fair elections, would probably even win such things. And so we're expecting these two people who don't like each other, who don't trust each other, to get along and to transition themselves out of jobs. These are all what-ifs that there's a lot of hope there. But I think realistically, I think the incentives are misaligned. And I think that's one thing we have to come to terms and grips with. Right now, I think there will be a relative peace maintained for the next few months, simply because the rainy seasons have begun. Movement is impossible for large numbers of people in South Sudan. So it's an incentive to look like they're conforming to international demands for a ceasefire, when in fact there would be a ceasefire imposed by nature anyway. The real test is going to come in September, October, when the rains end and normally hostilities begin again. Will they begin again? Will they break out in Juba, where these two sides are now technically together in a government, but both maintain separate forces in the city? These are all questions that remain to be answered.
Turning to you, Ambassador Shin, why can't the South Sudanese leaders seem to get their act together? And do you think that the sanctions recently renewed by the United Nations are liable to help or hurt the cause?
Well, I don't think the two leaders, Riek Machar and Salva Kiir, can get their act together because they both want the same job. And as long as that is not decided, there's going to be a lot of tension between the two of them. And it won't be decided at best until 2018 at this point, if they make it that far with this interim government. So it's really hard to be terribly optimistic about the short-term situation in southern Sudan, although certainly everyone wishes them well and wants the ceasefire to hold up. The problem, however, is now exacerbated by the fact that the economy has deteriorated so badly since the conflict broke out in 2013. The economy wasn't great, but it was better than it is now. And with the combination of the fall in the price of oil, the reduced production of the quantity of oil, to the point where a couple of months ago, the estimate was that the South Sudanese were making about $5 a barrel on their reduced production. It may have gone up a bit since then because the price of oil has gone up. So you're facing a really difficult situation, and you have huge inflation going on in the country. And you have one very prominent analyst of South Sudan who recently described it as a kleptocracy. And goodness knows, corruption has been a very serious problem there from the beginning. So there are a lot of economic reasons that militate against a successful outcome.
Well, back to you, Peter Pham, before we go to a break. You were in Khartoum. Are there any outstanding issues between Khartoum and Juba right now? What is the situation between the two countries?
The two countries, after the secession of South Sudan, its independence, the two countries still very much need each other, not only to transit such oil that is produced out to the world markets, but also because their economies were linked. Some of the agricultural output in the northern part of South Sudan, the only real markets are in the north. Then the peoples there along the border regions mix. There's still, but you know, that's not happening because the economy, as Ambassador Shin said, is in ruins. The infrastructure was never built out so that they could work out a relationship. And there's still disputes over certain territories, the Abyei territory, whether it goes north or south, whether a referendum can be held there. There are also disputes regarding supporting each other's rebels. The government of Salva Kiir in South Sudan has alleged that the rebel forces during the civil war there were supported by the government in Khartoum. The government of Khartoum accuses the government in South Sudan of supporting the SPLM north, the rebel forces in Blue Nile and other parts, other rebel forces in the north. And probably the truth lies in that both were guilty of interfering in each other's internal affairs. So there are a number of unsettled issues with both of them. And I think, unfortunately, the situation politically is such that there's room for mischief on both sides.
Ambassador Shin, room for mischief on both sides. Do you see any way where Khartoum can either help or hurt what's going on in South Sudan?
I do, and Peter's right. There is room for mischief on both sides, although in one sense, the Sudan-South Sudan relationship is kind of a good news story in all of this dismal commentary that we've just presented to you, in that I would have thought, quite frankly, that the situation would be even worse than it is between Khartoum and Juba. They do both understand that they need each other, and I think they are drawing upon that and actually trying to work together on some of these issues. So I can be a little bit optimistic upon the relationship between Khartoum and Juba.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Ambassador David Shin, former U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso. He's currently professor of international affairs at George Washington University. And J. Peter Pham, he's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, a think tank based here in Washington. And we're discussing Somalia, South Sudan, and soon we'll be talking about African counterterrorism efforts. Well, this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout-out to a loyal Chinese listener, Xu Dongqi. He's from the seaport city of Dalian in Liaoning province. If you want to hear your name on the show, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on Facebook. Back to you, Peter Pham. Let's now move on to counterterrorism efforts on the continent. In light of these terrible attacks, whether in Somalia, in West Africa, we're seeing more and more attempts to target soft targets, so to speak, hotels and so forth. And after a series of terrorist attacks on hotels and other tourist sites, the United States is increasing training exercises with militaries in Africa, focusing on how to defend these very targets. How would you assess these training exercises?
I think the United States has a long history of this, certainly in Africa as well, trying to help build the capacity of partner governments, whether it be military or, to a more limited extent, police forces. But we have to recognize that we're beginning from a very low starting point. And so, although a number of programs run by the U.S. State Department, as well as the U.S. Defense Department, as well as law enforcement agencies, are present on the continent, there's a lot of catch-up going on. And the territory is certainly vast, as well as the need. So some progress has been made, but I think some of the challenges are still ahead of us. Let me just cite, for example, a month ago, I was in West Africa looking at some of the humanitarian situation around the Lake Chad Basin. And one of the things that's happening is now, for the first time, humanitarian relief is beginning to go out of the major cities because Boko Haram has been pushed back. Now, that's going to create a whole new series of challenges that we're not even thinking that deeply about yet, which is the exposure that humanitarian groups and aid groups, as well as the populations that are moving back, are going to face. The good news is the pushing back of the militant group. The bad news is there's going to be an increase exponentially in exposure and potential risk. That's just one challenge one could tick off.
Turning to you, Ambassador Shin, for your take on whether it's in Burkina Faso, Kenya, or Gabon, we're seeing, you know, more American trainers funded by the State Department in particular. They're working with local police and security forces trying to combat these very groups we've been talking about, whether Al-Shabaab in East Africa, the IS affiliate in Libya, Boko Haram, of course, Nigeria, and AQIM. What is your assessment of these training exercises? Do you see an impact?
I think we are slowly seeing an impact, and I think this is the best way to go, to try to train up the Africans themselves to the point where they can combat these scourges. I think ultimately they can do it more effectively than outsiders can. And it's really going beyond training. It's providing equipment, some of it very sophisticated equipment, providing a lot of intelligence. There are some 300 American military personnel who have been assigned to Northern Cameroon to deal with the Boko Haram threat in the Lake Chad Basin region. My impression is that their primary task is providing intelligence, probably using drones, and providing that directly to our allied forces, joint multinational task force there, that are doing the actual combating of Boko Haram. This can be really crucial to the success of the Nigerians and the Cameroonians, the Chadians, Nigerians, and others. And I think that the more of that kind of thing we do, the better off our proposals are going to work.
Peter Pham, Ambassador Shin makes an interesting point. We read about the African security forces asking, actually, American military for help in intelligence surveillance, such as how to conduct cell phone tracking, how to use more human intelligence to forecast trouble. Do you see that as being effective in terms of strategy and tactics?
Very much. The most effective strategy is one where our African partners seize ownership of the challenges they face and where they're able to build up their own capacity, not only to take care of themselves, the individual nations, but in the best of cases, going beyond that. A good example is the training that has been given and is being given actually again this month in additional exercises in the Central African country of Gabon. The primary beneficiary has actually been the National Parks Agency in the country, which 15% of the country is a nature preserve, protect the biodiversity of the country. And they've received a lot of training from especially the U.S. Marines, but other units as well. And what's been interesting is we've seen over the last few years, as their confidence has been built up, not only are they able to combat trafficking in wildlife and poaching, but also pass that training on. They've gone on to engage in operations in the Central African Republic to protect elephants there, in Mali to protect the desert elephants. They've even gone as far east as Uganda, where they've helped train the parks police there on poaching. So it's where you get to the point where you're training the trainers. It's a good measure of the success and the value added of the programming.
Ambassador Shin, anything to add or subtract?
I would just point out, you mentioned the increasing number of attacks on soft targets in places like hotels in Burkina Faso and Cote d'Ivoire.
Right.
And that's interesting. I suspect it indicates an effort by Al-Qaeda-linked groups, particularly, to maintain their brand, to stay on the front pages of the paper because of the increasing competition they're getting from the Islamic State in places like Libya, and even allegedly with Boko Haram, which says it is linked to the Islamic State, although the evidence of that is questionable. But the Al-Qaeda-linked groups, they want to stay relevant, and they can do that by blowing up hotels. It's very simple to do.
Indeed, and really chilling for the populations and, of course, for those who want to visit. And, of course, it's a disaster for the tourism industry. Well, let's move on. And before we close, Peter Pham, I wanted to talk about the Chadian dictator, Hissen Habré, who was recently sentenced to life in prison. He was found guilty of crimes against humanity, war crimes, and torture. And, of course, he was sentenced by a court in Senegal. Rights groups are hailing this landmark verdict is a strong warning to leaders who brutalize their citizens. What is your takeaway from this verdict?
I think the conviction and sentencing of the former Chadian dictator really is an example that it may take a long time, but it's worth the effort. This is a man who was overthrown more than a quarter of a century ago, 1990. He then went into exile and was protected essentially by the Senegalese government that gave him sanctuary. And it only was with the election of the current president of Senegal, Macky Sall, that there was a political will on the part of the government to do something about it. The good news story, this was a case of the victims being empowered, taking upon themselves to gather the evidence, to gather the testimony, build up the case. And so unlike politically charged prosecutions and other times, this is one where the victims themselves, the African victims, pushed the agenda, demanded it. And for the first time ever, a former African leader was tried in an African court, the extraordinary African chambers inside the courts of Senegal. So it was a hybrid of Senegalese judges within the Senegalese judiciary and other African judges from other countries coming together, trying a former African leader in Africa, on African soil. So I think it's a victory for the victims, it's a victory for human rights, and it's a victory for the idea that Africans can actually hold, at least some of the time, perpetrators responsible.
And some people say, Ambassador Shin, that it's a signal to dictators around the world that the victims will not relent until justice is done. How significant do you think this verdict is and the fact that it was handed down by a Senegalese court?
Well, it is significant. It's a question as to how much resonance it has elsewhere. I must say, talking about Hissen Habré brings back old memories. In 1982, I was the American chargé d'affaires at the embassy in N'Djamena in Chad. And I was in charge when he seized power in N'Djamena and was the first American to meet with him at the time. Boy, I concluded back in that first meeting, this was one tough customer, and he has indeed proven to be that. But I think we ought not to be too salubrious about what this means for the future. This could be a one-off event. And if it is, that's unfortunate. I agree with Peter that it's a very significant event in the African context, and it's really good that the Africans themselves have taken this on. But are there going to be others, or is this sort of the end of it? And that remains to be seen.
Indeed. And on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ambassador David Chin, former U.S. Ambassador to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso, and J. Peter Pham. He's director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council. As always, gentlemen, thank you so much for your wonderful insights.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Suleiman Tarawali. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.